the wise perceives all, and the fool walks in blind, yet both remain destined the same end to find. I said in my heart, like a fool came to be, just so will it happen the same way to me. So what was the reason I had become wise? I said in my heart, what a useless surprise. And it just occurred to me, maybe what a stupid surprise is another possible translation. For Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 14 and 15 from today's daily scripture, which we just read from the Word Green version of 2020, that was. And so we've begun our study for today of the article, The Ark of Urartu. And I've got to find where we are here. Where are we? Oh, there we are. So I see there's the same icon in two different places on my list of tabs, and that was a little confusing. I want to show you some interesting things today. First, I want to show you Genesis chapter 10, verse 30, where it says, and their place of dwelling, speaking of the sons of Shem. Actually, these are, of course, the sons of Eber, right? And Eber was a descendant of Shem. The sons of Shem were Elam, Asher, Arpachshad, Lud, and Aram, from verse 22. So Arpachshad, verse 24, became father to Shelah, and Shelah became father to Eber. We're going to see the significance of these names or these patriarchs in the Chinese history in due time. But from verse 24 there, Eber was the father then of two sons of verse 25, one of whom was named Peleg. But the other one, Joktan, was the father of other sons, and their place of dwelling came to extend, in verse 30, from Mesha as far as Sephar. And the word Mesha we saw is referring to the place where the ark landed. We also saw that it was called Masha. There was a name, and the mountain called Nisir, or the landing place where the ark landed, is related to this Mesha word as well. The first place of dwelling of the survivors of the deluge was Mesha. And as far as Sephar, Sephar means the separation. Like it's the word in English, separate comes from that word Sephar. And so it's interesting because that shows that the Chinese people were separated from all the other Middle Eastern people, and Sephar is the mountainous region of the east, which refers to the far eastern region of the Chinese, which we're going to be covering in chapter 2 and even in the final paragraph here today. And there's a map, so we have this map, and look at in China. In the Far East, there's a place called Hebei, a lot like the name Heber. And the Yellow River leads from its source in the Tibetan Plateau all the way in a meandering fashion into the place called Hebei in China in the Far East. So the Yellow River, and we believe that corresponds and is related to the Yellow Emperor of China, one of the earliest emperors of China, who also we identify with Heber, the Yellow Emperor. So the Yellow River flowing to Hebei connects Heber with the Yellow Emperor and with all of our discussion that we're going to have here. There's a beautiful group of movies, beautiful scenery in the movies, wonderful, wonderful stories in the movies which are related to the Monkey King, which one of which is called Dream Journey 3, The Land of Many. That's one of the movies. I've been starting to watch that, but there's also, there are the Monkey King movies. They're quite splendid. They're spectacular in their scenery. They have wonderful stories and morals and things, teachings in there, in those movies. And there's a priest in the movie, and there's the other characters that travel with him, one of whom is the Monkey King. But it's a beautiful, beautiful set of Chinese cultural documentary, almost, movies, which relate to the things that we're going to be talking about in this article. When we talk about the Chinese history, it's going to be somehow connected. The story now, chapter 1, paragraph 12 of the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express, how the nations spread out to fill the earth, descending from Noah's three sons. That story is found in Genesis chapter 10, as we were just reading. The nations descending from Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and the dividing of the earth amongst these sons, has been of great usefulness in understanding the families of our ancestors. But the Chinese ancestry has been separated from the West. There's that word, separation. Sifar. Yet, Chinese history preserves, in its most ancient record evidently, a portion of the history of one ancestor, Shem. At Genesis 10:30, which we just read, Shem is from Mesha as far as Sifar. Sifar is the eastern hill country, or alternatively the mountain of the east. The evidence of a correspondence between Chi Yu of Jiuli, meaning nine black, tribe. The Jiuli tribe is the nine black tribe, and the correspondence between Chi Yu and Nimrod, and of that correspondence between the Yellow Emperor and Heber, is considerable. There's a battle, you know, between the nine black tribe leader, Chi Yu, and a person in Chinese history called Shennong, and that is somebody who we also relate to Heber, or rather Shelah. Shennong is Shelah, who is the son of Heber, or the son of Arpachshad, isn't he? We're going to have to see all, we're going to have to learn all these things as we go along. Arpachshad became father to Shelah. Shelah became father to Eber, right. See, Eber was the Yellow Emperor, but Shelah was Shennong. There's so when we look at the Chinese history, let's see what we find. We're going to have to do all this somehow, right? And this is the Wikipedia article that originally appeared in 2015. It was still there on Wikipedia. It's not there today. But it shows that the first emperor of China was called Noah. Nua corresponds to Noah. And, of course, he's mythological in this account, which is making him rather ancient. And then we have the next emperor, Yu Chao, then Sui Ren. So Yu Chao we would take to be Shem, right? Sui Ren would be Arpachshad, the son of Shem, if we just go in order like that. But we have to have then Arpakshad had a son called Kainan, and that's Fushi. And then we have the Yan Emperor, right, who we identify with Shennong, right? And he's not the Yellow Emperor. He's the first emperor of China, but he dates from 2737 to 2699. And I got this from the Wayback Machine because somehow or other, Wikipedia was changed so that the link no longer worked from our article to get to this article, but it's there as now I've preserved it, you know, or saved a copy of it. So we have this now just the way I had it back when I wrote the article. These are the dates that I give in the article that we're reading now. This is the Yan, the Flame Emperor, I believe he's called, Yan Emperor, and the Yellow Emperor we identify with Heber, you see, but Shennong is identified with Shelah. Now Shelah is the son of, let's see, it says that Arpakshad became father to Shelah, but don't we, that's not true though, because we know there's someone missing in that when we go back to Brenton. Arpakshad begot Kainan, and Kainan begot Selah. Shelah is the grandson of Arpakshad through Kainan from the Septuagint version, which is the same chapter, Genesis 10, in the Greek Septuagint as translated by Sir Lancelot Charles Brenton, I think his name is. It's Brenton. Sir Lancelot Charles Brenton or Sir Charles Lancelot Brenton? Something, some name like that. Let's find out what his name is if we can find out here. Can we find that out from this? Probably we can't. Public domain, this is, right? Let's look at the copyright. Sir Lancelot Charles Lee Brenton. Right. In the public domain, but this is the Septuagint version of the Bible from Genesis chapter 10. Kainan was left out of the Masoretic text, and we don't have it in many Bibles, you see. But we do know the Chinese history also preserves it, as we just saw in our PDF file here. We've got Fushi, who corresponds to Kainan, the son of Arpakshad, who's the son of Shem, who's the son of Noah, and the lineage is preserved with Shennong being Shelah, and Shelah's son Heber being the Yellow Emperor. So that is very important. And we have this amazing correspondence between Nimrod, who fought a battle against, I believe, in the book of, either the book of Jubilees or the book of, I'm thinking, is it the book of Jasher or the book of Jubilees? Let's see if we can find out. It's going to be in the next chapter anyway. We'll research it later. I'm not going to worry about it right now, but this is fascinating because the Yellow Emperor invented a south-pointing chariot. Can you imagine? So Heber, who we identify with the Yellow Emperor, and also the word Heber is similar to the word emperor, the E-B, E-R, and the E-P-E-R are similar, right? Emperor. So it's fascinating there's a connection there. But also Fushi, whom we identify with Kainan, is also identified with Kangji. Kainan and Kangji are similar in their names, right? In the Kangji and King Einan. And we identify King Ji as Fuxi. Okay, so let's go back and read a little more here. Chinese history preserves evidently a portion of the history of one ancestor, Shem, as we said. And there's a there's an evidence, there's evidence, a good amount of evidence with the of similarity in the stories of Chi Yu and Nimrod, comparing those two characters, one from the Bible being Nimrod and the Chinese character Chi Yu, and also the Yellow Emperor from Chinese history and Heber from the Bible. They correspond, and the dates correspond, because if you look at when, you know, Shennong said to have ruled here, 2700 to 2737 to 2699, that's exactly in the century of the Tower of Babel, you know, when Nimrod was around, you know, he was living. And Shennong, so we're going to come to that in chapter 2. We're going to talk about this correspondence later on. I'm not sure if we should get into it too much right now, because it's too much information right now, but, I mean, I haven't even looked at it myself recently. And, okay, the Yellow Emperor and Heber seem to be correlated well, even by our map there. More than that, the first Chinese emperor to be dated from written records is Fuxi, given as reigning 2852 to 2737, right here in our PDF file, and that's from sources 1, 4, and 5, which, if you look at the bottom of this table, it's according to the records of the Grand Historian and the Shangshu Dazhuan and Bai Hu Tong Ji and Diwang Shiji as well. Those are the sources for these things that give us this dating for Shennong, who's also called the Flame Emperor, the Yan Emperor. If you look at one of the symbols there, it looks like a flame. That's why he's called the Flame Emperor. It's in his name. There's a flame there. Okay. Now, the Yellow Emperor, remarkably, is said to have invented a south-pointing chariot. Can you imagine? A chariot that automatically pointed to the south. And if you watch the Monkey King movies, there are a lot of interesting, quirky things in those movies that show that Chinese history is full of these kinds of curious things. And the Yellow Emperor, who was the inventor of the south pointing chariot, was Heber in our corresponding history. And Kang Ji, who invented writing, is also identified with King Einan, so that those two are respectively identified. The Yellow Emperor with Heber, right? And Kang Ji with King Einan. But Shem was the father of Arpakshad. He was the father of King Einan. King Einan was the father of Shelah. Shelah was the father of Heber. Furthermore, Kang Ji is here identified as Fuxi himself, as I just mentioned. In China, compare China with the name Shinar. Shinar and China, almost identical, right? So Shinar, where the Tower of Babel was, and China, it's like the same name, almost. History began with script in China on bones. In Chinese mythology is where we find a part of our story, and the Monkey King is part of Chinese mythology, of course. High King is a story, tells of Fuxi, father of civilization. Now, isn't that similar to Fuxi? But it's a little confused, because the father of civilization was Noah, and Fuxi was a descendant of Noah, who was as we identified him, Kainan, right? But Fu He, the father of civilization, was said to have survived a worldwide flood, the deluge, in other words, survived a worldwide flood in the Chinese story, High King. And by his three sons, the earth was repopulated, and so Fu He must be, in fact, Noah, right? But, of course, Fu He is also Kainan, if he's Fu Shi. So it's a little confused in the names. The Chinese mythology is very confused in the names. In fact, Chinese mythology has several sets of different names for the same characters, and that's necessitated a little bit of unraveling to sort out the Chinese history and put it into order. But a story without reference or signpost, originating in Sin or Sin from the land of Shinar. Compare with Sinar, Sinar, Sin. Those words are all related to this word Shinar. Sign, S-I-G-N, like a signpost, and the word sin. It's all connected. The story of writing had an even earlier origin in Kainan, though, because this one, the earlier Kainan, or Kenan, who was the fourth from Adam, and was a wise man who, according to the book of Jasher, at the age of 40, ruled over men and led them to knowledge and to serve God. He knew, this earlier Kainan, that Jehovah would destroy the sons of men who had sinned and that he would bring upon them a deluge. He prophesied about the deluge, and he wrote the details of it on stone tablets, according to Jasher chapter 2, verses 11 and 14. 11 through 14. The book of Jubilees relates to us of a son of Arpakshad, Kainam, or Kainan, how he was taught to write by his father, and how he found an ancient writing inscribed on rock as a sinful or signful record of the watchers of the heavens. See, it was considered a sin, evidently, to write down things that pertained to the signs of the heavenly bodies as they moved in the heavens. In their looking for omens in sun and moon and stars, in order to sin, they did it. Kainan wrote a copy of it, but he knew it to be sin, and so said nothing to Noah out of fear. That's from the book of Jubilees, chapter 8, verses 1 to 5. Kainan, and we date him, he's also called Kainam, 3145 to 2685 BCE in the genealogy. So he fits in the time period of this Fu Shi, we see from 2852 to 2737 for his period of rule. According to that tale in the book of Jubilees, he's a son of Rasuija, daughter of Susan, daughter of Elam, as might suit his appearance, looking like a Persian, who also appeared somewhat similar to the way the Chinese people look and the Eastern people, as well as the geographical location. The dates is right also in the genealogy. He's well suited to the dates in the genealogy, right? Also, he fits with the Chinese history according to the dating of our chronology. It's so absolutely fantastically perfect or phenomenal that it's got any correspondence at all. More importantly, Kainan was alive in Peleg's days, 2749 Peleg. In his days, the earth was divided or separated, Sephar, see? The word separation from that word, Sephar. Genesis 10, 25 and 30, Luke 3 and 36 would be including the name of Kainan in his descent, and we looked at the Greek Septuagint, which mentioned Kainan, right? Thus we may now restore a portion of the ancient history. May we meet with an humble and hard-working Chinese people from the Kunlun Mountains, where the Yellow Emperor had his mythological palace, to Hebei province of East China, where he later lived, a traveling antiquity of a long-forgotten separation, one we pray share with you, the untold story. And what a story it is. And you'll get such an intense impression of it if you watch any of the Monkey King movies about how enamored the Chinese people are with their ancient history. It's just so wonderful. So 25, we've got a few minutes. You know what I want to do? I want to look at the next, later, the many years after, 22 years after the movie Kon-Tiki. Where is the movie? Where did I put it? Is it here? Here? Yeah. In 1972, Thor Heyerdahl began another expedition from Africa this time, and sailing on a reed boat. Here we have it. Okay.
Sail from Africa to America in a boat made out of papyrus reeds. Men determined to discover whether it is possible that ancient people at the dawn of history, sailed across oceans in handmade reed boats and spread their civilization to other continents and islands of the sea. Preposterous, the experts say. Ocean waves will break their boat to pieces. The salt water will dissolve the papyrus. But the possibility haunts the famous builder of the raft, Kon-Tiki. And so he, Thor Heyerdahl, builds a papyrus boat himself, and he calls it Ra. Why does Heyerdahl find this challenge so fascinating? The key to that question is carved on the chest of an ancient stone statue on Easter Island, far off the west coast of South America. A reed boat on an island where once no reeds grew. But because they grow from pieces of root and not from wind-blown seeds, had to be brought there from America by men. Brought how? In what sort of boats? Other things have been brought by ocean-going men to Easter Island and other islands nearby. Pyramids, now reduced to these temple platforms, and once great step-shaped monuments dedicated to the worship of the sun, Ra. Architecture, stones accurately carved and fitted together. reed boats, still sailing like ghosts in paintings on temple walls, and in these models, with one or more sails carved long ago in stone. The older natives of Easter Island still know the art of making boats of reeds. They use the Totora reed, a characteristic South American variety. The ancestors of these natives brought the reed with them from America and planted it in the fresh water of Easter Island's crater lakes. The natives build two kinds of boats, one for swimming near the shore, a float in the shape of an elephant tusk. The other, a boat with raised bow and stern, which can be built in any size, large or small, and which the natives say is completely worthy for sailing the sea. More than 25 years ago, Heyerdahl began to wonder how the culture and vegetation of South America came to Easter Island and beyond to other islands of Polynesia. Peru's coastline is the nearest to the Pacific Islands. From there, the ocean currents flow inexorably toward them. Heyerdahl sailed these currents in 1947 in a raft he made of balsa wood, sailed them far past Easter Island to show how ancient people might have traveled westward to Polynesia.
Yeah, it was a raft made of balsa wood. The caption wasn't quite correct there. That was the Kon-Tiki that we watched. And so we're seeing the beginning of the raw expedition. And it's once again Thor Heyerdahl, some 20 years later, still busy at work, this time sailing from Africa west once again. And so that's it for today's study. And it's been a pleasure. And we're back soon, tomorrow, hopefully, to continue this interesting study. Remarkable what happened with the loss of the data from some sources, which does happen. We were able to recover it because Jehovah is a powerful God, and he provided us a way to get the information. So it's 17:34 hours North American Eastern Daylight Time, September 14th, 2024 of the Common Era. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. Thank you for listening and watching. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty and this is Cassie saying bye for now. And that was Chapter 1, Paragraph 12 of the Ark of Urartu. The Orient Express. We finished Chapter 1.